Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Walter Current is a regular reviewer for the New York Times Book Review, and his work appears in many publications, including The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, Vogue, Time, and Esquire. He's the author of 6 previous works of fiction: My Hard Bargain, Stories, She Needed Me, Thumbsucker, Up in the Air, Mission to America, and The Unbinding. Kern is a graduate of Princeton and attended Oxford on a scholarship, but in that brief description of his education lies a larger story, one that he tells in his new book, Lost in the Meritocracy, The Underachievement of an Overachiever. As critic Melanie Thernstrom writes, imagine Holden Caulfield at Princeton, stranded in a rooming group of sadistic trust fund heirs, losing his soul to deconstructionism, dropping acid, flouting the honor code, flirting with disciplinary action, and heading for a breakdown. Kern's book chronicles one bright young mind's journey through a deeply flawed educational system and the search for intellectual fulfillment in America. Amanda Fortini, a Harvard graduate, is also from the tribe of overachievers. She's written for The New Yorker, The New Republic, New York Magazine, The New York Times Magazine, and Slate, among other publications. And her essays have been published widely in several anthologies, including Best American Political Writing, 2008, The Best of Slate, and An Uncertain Inheritance, Writers on Caring for Family. It's a great honor to please join me in welcoming Walter Kern and Amanda Fortini. Thank you very much.
Good evening. Thank you, everyone, for coming. So we're just going to have a kind of informal conversation about the book, and then after about 40 minutes, we're going to open it up to questions from all of you. So, you know, be thinking about them as we talk. So the book grew out of an article that you wrote for The Atlantic Monthly in 2005. How could you talk about how that article came about?
The article was called Lost in the Meritocracy, and its origin was really my need after 20 years out of Princeton to complain bitterly about my time there. Having harvested all the privilege and good fortune that that education brings, I had a deep residue of kind of confusion and resentment over my time there. I felt in general that people didn't write honestly about these elite universities. They wrote about them as they used to write about the church, as places where only good things happened and only miraculous growth occurred. And in fact, my experience had been quite different, and I felt that it was time that I unburdened myself, and I thought that it was time that America started thinking more clearly and realistically about its education system, and especially what it considers the ultra high echelon side of it.
I noticed that the subtitle to the article was "How I Traded an Education for a Ticket to the Ruling Class." I was wondering if you could speak about that, if you felt that was that accurately conveyed what was in the article, or
you know, writers are not responsible for the headlines that editors use, and it's always the headline that influences people's perception of the piece. If you see a member of the ruling class sitting here, please tell me where he is. But the point of that really was that this is a story about my education really from age 4 on. It happens to culminate at Princeton with, you know, this terrible mental breakdown that I had. But my thesis was that the education became less and less about acquiring knowledge and more about cracking the code of the establishment. And that's what that subhead attempted to convey.
Something that you just mentioned, I was going to ask you later, but I'll ask you now. You say that it's something that you learned very early on, kind of cracking the code or to the establishment, or learning how to kind of game the system. You talk in the book about, even as an eight-year-old, I think you call yourself an eight-year-old art class fraud or something. You learn how to do it in art class. You learn how to do it with multiple choice tests. Can you just sort of draw the line from your early education?
Yeah, I'll talk a little about my elementary school education. Now, it's important that I divulge my age, you know, with pinpoint accuracy here, so that people know exactly what cohort I was riding with. I'm 46. And when I was 8 years old in public school in a tiny town in Minnesota, art class was dominated by this sort of, feel-good expressionism as brought to us by highly trained art teachers who, you know, gave us some tempura and watercolors and asked us to put our feelings onto paper. And I first learned that, well, so what that meant to me was that I draw things at first. So I would draw, I was very good at drawing dinosaurs. I'd practiced copying out of books. Well, the teacher said, no, those are drawings, those are pictures, that's not art, that's copying. We want to see your feelings. And so I thought, well, what the hell could that mean? And I thought, well, blurriness is kind of an essential part of emotion and indistinctiveness. And so I noticed that as I kind of clawed at the paper with my tempura and so on, that I was getting more and more praise. And they'd say, well, what is that picture? You know, it would be like some horrible, ugly mess that looks like spilled mustard. What does that express? And then I'd have to come up with stories, you know. Well, that's how I feel when my dad's away at work. And then their eyes would light up, and I started to realize art is not what you put on the paper. It's what you say about what you put on the paper. And you know, so that was one of those revelations that kind of slowly, gradually, progressively turned me into a horrible little fraud, you know, and got me where I am today.
So how did you decide to turn the article into a book? How did that come about? Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, somebody asked me once, do you write for yourself or who do you write for? And you know, when I look at my sales, I realize I do write for myself. And my immediate family. In this case, I wrote this article, and I started getting letters, and the magazine started getting letters from people who talked about their own journey through the educational system, and especially their own college years. And there were so many people, and they didn't have to have gone to Princeton or Harvard like, you know, wonderful you and me. They went to, you know, all sorts of places. And I didn't originally go to Princeton. I went to McAllister College in St. Paul and transferred to Princeton. But they'd all experienced this sort of immigration from their own family and their own town or city or neighborhood into the larger culture. And there seemed to be certain certain constants in terms of people's experience. One was that they felt they were going to be exposed as phony. Another was that they felt that they didn't belong there. Often they felt persecuted or alienated by the mainstream groups that dominated the colleges. If they were black and they went to a school that was mostly white, you know. Michelle Obama, by the way, was just out 2 years ahead of me at Princeton and wrote a sociology thesis about how, you know, in which she sort of abstractly said, this really sucked. But anyway, so the momentum of these letters and this response caused me to feel, I really hit on something here, I should examine it at greater length.
It seemed to me that there was maybe something that you hit on is that sort of loneliness of the person who jumps from one, you know, through his test-taking ability or whatever, from one class perhaps to another, or one environment to another, a very foreign environment. It seems like a kind of culture shock. If I could just read one sentence from your book, you said, "I have other comrades in estrangement way out here on the bell curve's leading edge, where our talent for multiple choice tests had landed us without even the vaguest survival instructions." And it seemed a kind of lament almost for the for those who found themselves lost in the meritocracy. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, this book could have easily been called Poor Little Smart Boy. You know, I mean, I've noticed a strain of hostility in some of the reviews, and to the tune of, you got to Princeton, what do you have to bitch about, you know? To which I want to answer, only people who've been at Princeton know what they have to bitch about. Which is plenty. But anyway, yeah, it is a story of loneliness. Our education system, put very simply, consists of this, especially that slice of it which involves public school, which is what I, which is the track I took. You get there, you all show up by virtue of living in the same zip code. They then find out who can recite the alphabet and who already knows how to count. Those people move ineluctably to the head of the class. The teachers like them. They make their jobs easier. The rest of the people, if they persist in not learning their alphabet or being able to count, fall slowly by the wayside into special groups, which are considered marginal. As time goes on, they start subjecting you to various tests, standardized tests in the even more so nowadays with this No Child Left Behind business, that place you in percentile rankings. You find out as a student at some point, somewhere between fourth and sixth grade, which percentile of the great American population of young people you fall in. If it happens to be that you fall in one of the higher percentiles, you start getting a little arrogant, a little cocky. You start thinking you're a little special. Maybe, you know, God picked you out. And then you start playing to that image of yourself while desperately fearing that you might fall a few percentile, or you don't actually belong there and it was a mistake. Then you go through your teenage years and something called the SAT looms, which is really a jumped up IQ test. And IQ tests were originally conceived for draftees in World War I. They needed a way to quickly decide who are the sheep and who are the goats in this vast influx of North Dakotans that we want to send off to France to die? You know, who should be in the front and who should be in the back? So they came up with all these abstract problems that supposedly didn't have to do with the technical knowledge that you held, but had to do with the agility and reasoning facility in your brain, the sort of intrinsic intelligence that they thought existed, which I don't believe does. And so you take that SAT test, you aim toward it, and if you do well on it, it spits you out into one of these, if you wish to go there, if you're sort of ambitious, one of these elite universities, where you are then surrounded not just by your cohort of 98th percentile people, but a lot of rich people whose parents gave money to the colleges, or who, you know, founded the Darien, Connecticut Yacht Club. And for 4 years, you're there on a par being a smart kid with the rich kids who don't like you and who know that you will take their orders someday. And you confront a class system which in America doesn't supposedly exist, but actually endures despite, you know, it will still be there when Obama's gone, I promise. Yeah, and so that was my education. And it is, to be really long-winded, a very lonely journey which takes you out of community, which takes you out of relation to other beings, which sets you in some sort of statistical competition with your peers, and ends up leaving you the bright, achieving, lonely, quite insane American meritocrat.
But you said that in the response to the article, and I'm assuming the book as well, it wasn't just people who went to kind of elite, the Ivy League schools or whatever, yeah. who found something to respond to in the book?
Oh, no, yeah. You don't have to do well at this system to be molded by it. You know, in fact, I could have probably written another book had I at some age, you know, actively rebelled or fallen out of the system. You know, this is, for example, when learning to read, I was taught to read by a kit that appeared in our school called the Scientific Research Associates Reading Comprehension Kit, produced by the IBM Corporation. It consisted of a box of plasticized cards with little essays about, you know, the journey of the salmon or, you know, Neil Armstrong, first man on the moon. And then there were a list of computer scorable questions at the bottom. And what this SRA kit taught you was to scan that paragraph as fast as you damn could for big words that shouldn't be there because they were obviously only there because you'd be tested on them later, to look for numbers and proper nouns which were capitalized because they would obviously be the answers to the questions at the bottom, and to move as quickly through the color-coded arc from orange to yellow to purple that constituted progress in reading comprehension. They should have called it reading, you know, wastefulness. Because what you were doing was throwing away everything that wasn't a right answer in your search for, you know, correct responses. And now a lot of education is like that. It's about not learning things so that you aren't distracted from getting right answers, which are really what the system wants from you.
I read a piece that you wrote in the Huffington Post last week that was very interesting, talking about the way that your thoughts that Barack Obama is also a product of this this system, and you use the term aptocrat. And I was wondering if you could elaborate about that.
Well, what we were being tested on, you know, I happened to be an Obama supporter. As a result of an experience I had here 2 years ago, I read with George McGovern, and it was the greatest privilege. He was the most wonderful, erudite, giving, and honest politician I'd ever spoken to, and he turned me on to Barack Obama. But, you know, most recently, I've looked at Barack Obama's administration and his family and so on, and I've seen in them a kind of consummate product of this American journey toward good grades and Ivy League excellence. And I have to say, it spooks me just a tiny bit to think that our government once again is staffed and led by a bunch of people who know each other from their college years, who got there by, I hate to say it, a combination of very assiduous brown nosing, high intellect, and wonderfully fluent rhetorical skills. And when something happens, like what's going on in Iran now, say, or something that requires sort of real-world, crunchy, hard judgment, in which there are no right answers necessarily, and in which failure is a possibility, because really this education system does nothing more thoroughly than instill in children a fear, absolute terror of failure. And so when I see the best and the brightest sort of my generation there at the helm, it's a little like Groucho Marx. He doesn't want to be a member of a club that would have him. I don't know that I want to be part of a country led by people like me. And so not to criticize them, but I do get the willies that these are people formed not by war, deprivation, or real struggles, but by the damned SAT test. Because this is not a test. This is the real thing.
Okay, I want to ask you to read a little bit from the book. I think probably the best way to get a sense of the kind of collision you experienced with the American elite at Princeton is to hear you read it in your own words. So I was wondering if you could read the passages about your the Minnesota, the small Minnesotan town where you come from first.
Okay.
In my galley, it's page 24. There's a little bit about it, and then page 40.
Yeah. Okay, this isn't all going to stitch together perfectly, but page 24, you mean the beginning of this here? Or that thing about the summertime?
I would like you to read both, if you could, because I think it really gives a sense of where you come from.
Marine, Minnesota, where I attended grade school, was a tidy, blufftop river town that belonged on a cake plate. The place seemed baked, not built. Its business district centered around a park that featured a whitewashed wooden bandstand where actual barbershop quartets performed, consisted of a general store, a gas station, a hamburger restaurant, and a public library. Its people were mostly of Scandinavian heritage, meaning they didn't talk much but smiled constantly. Most had grown up there or on nearby farms, but a few, like my family, had come from larger places where it was possible to witness a crime, contract an illness other than a cold, and attend a social gathering that wasn't a toddler's birthday party or a funeral for a 95-year-old. The perfect place to raise a child, some felt. But that wasn't why my father moved us there. He did it because the houses cost next to nothing, and he could bow hunt in the nearby forests, fish in the river for smallmouth bass, and work in the yard in nothing but long underwear without being seen by his colleagues at 3M. He could also spit chewing tobacco on the sidewalk and go around covered in buck scent, wearing camouflage, with blood from the deer he'd just killed smeared on his hands. Marines Elementary School was on a hill. It was the largest man-made structure in town, one of the newest and by far the ugliest. Shape rectangular, material beige brick. Constructed with tax money, it looked like tax money, a fiscal line item come to joyless life. Even the playground equipment seemed bureaucratic, a stainless steel slide and a set of iron monkey bars on which one could picture army recruits glumly sweating their way through basic training. From the moment I entered the building's long tiled hallway, its colorless walls inadequately brightened with red and yellow construction paper maple leaves, I wanted out. But out, I knew, meant through.
We can read the.
Well, I'm gonna.
We'll skip there and read your roommates about your roommates.
Oh, okay.
Unless you wanna.
Well, I'm gonna tell you just a couple things, just to give you a sense of the narrative here. You know, I went in the early '70s to this elementary school, and even though it was in little tiny Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, and it literally was in Lake Wobegon, Garrison Keillor used to stay in this town in the summer and collect stories that he then turned into the Lake Wobegon books and monologues. It was a weird place. My fifth grade teacher, here was class in fifth grade. The Wounded Knee confrontation, if you're old enough to remember that, was going on at the time on the Pine Ridge Reservation in North Dakota. American Indian activists were confronting federal troops. Our fifth grade teacher every day just put the TV on in the front of the room and showed us news about Wounded Knee and gave us this warped lesson in American history, which led us to understand that these ungrateful Indians, for which we'd done everything, I mean, we'd given them some of our best land, they didn't really have to work, you know, they got their money with food, or their food with food stamps, you know, and here they were ungratefully confronting the benign and benevolent U.S. government. So we rooted against these Indians every day. And then, you know, finally the government overran their compound and led them off in shackles and chains, and we were led to applaud and so on. The next year we spent the entire year putting on a production of Tom Sawyer, and we had a teacher who liked to put his hands in the pockets of our jeans to look for objects that weren't there. He'd say, I know you're hiding a rabbit's foot in your jeans. No, I don't have anything, Mr. Hawkinson. No, I know you do. And he'd put his hands down there. This guy later killed himself by putting his car in front of a railroad track when the county sheriff caught on 20 years later to his tricks. So it was a mad place. It wasn't just a cake plate normative American town. But that was my background. And I hung out at the gas station and I went fishing. And everybody I thought in Minnesota made the same amount of money. The only difference is that some had slightly newer cars. But that was just a cycle of buying things, you know. Then I got to Princeton and found out that some people owned the car companies.
Yeah, so why don't we go to Princeton?
Okay.
And you can.
Where do you think I should start that? Should I describe the roommates?
Yeah, the roommates is on 75. Describe them, and then maybe we skip ahead a few pages. Then came the business of the furniture.
Yeah. My first semester at Princeton, I had four roommates who resembled no one I'd ever known. Peter, a foppish piano prodigy with a mature, fine, bristled mustache, who dreamed of writing Broadway musical comedies and spent his leisure time in a robe and slippers, smoking Benson & Hedges Menthol 100s and hunching vulture-like over his black Steinway, plinking out show tunes about doe-eyed ingenues who'd been seduced and ruined by caddish tycoons. Jennifer, the composer's plump heiress girlfriend, whose father owned a nightclub and often sent a limousine on weekends so that his daughter could party with celebrities who, as I learned from a framed snapshot which sat on a dresser in her and Peter's bedroom, included the two best-known members of the Bee Gees. Tim, the son of a New York journalist, who kept his cheeks fresh with oil of Olay and treated the composer and the heiress as surrogate parents, addressing them in baby talk and asking them to tuck him in at night, which they did, complete with fairy tales. And Joshua, an earnest Long Island Quaker kid with a close-trimmed, pious-seeming red beard, who played guitar and protested apartheid, which I pretended to be concerned about, too, although I wasn't certain what it was. The SATs hadn't required such trivial knowledge.
Do you want to skip ahead a little bit?
Yeah, so...
Read that last that passage about what they kind of... How they treat you, basically.
It all started one Sunday afternoon?
80, I think it's on...
Oh, okay. Okay, here's what happened in this room, to give you some context. I move into this little room. I had two T-shirts, one that had a pocket. It was a T-shirt with a pocket, one that didn't. And one pair of shoes and some jeans. And I'm living with these people. One day I come home to this this suite of rooms. It's three bedrooms around a big common room. And what had been the sterile institutional furniture that Princeton put there was gone. And I'd noticed that something was going on because there was a Bloomingdale's van parked out front of the dorm. I came in, and there was suddenly this magnificent Bloomsbury-an salon where our crappy living room had been, with a oriental rug and a chintz sofa and a big color TV, and of course the Steinway is still there in the corner, and lace curtains. And I said, wow, you know, what happened here? I went into my bedroom, the little bedroom where I had two bunks and a milk crate bookcase where I lived with the Quaker who just sat all day stone saying, you know, I dreamed I saw a silver spaceship fly, you know, and there on my desk was a bill for, you know, $600-$800. I can't remember. I didn't adjust for inflation, but, you know, now it would be thousands. And I said, what's this? And then it's Jennifer, whose father owned one of the biggest hotels in New York, whose father owned an island in the Bahamas, whose father, you know, had many pictures of him with Maurice Gibb. said, "That's your share of the that's your share of the new room, new furniture." I said, "What, my share? I never asked. I never what?" She said, "Well, you aren't going to pay it." No, I don't have that money. I mean, I don't have any money. I can barely pay my phone bill. She said, "Well, just call your parents." And I said, "Well, I can't. My parents won't pay this." She said, "Well, just go around them to their accountant." So anyway, I said, "F you, I can't pay this. I'm not going to pay it." I finally got some spine, and they said, "Fine, we're going to have a class, a suite-wide meeting to decide what to do with you, what to do about you." So I sat in my room while there used to be a show called Juvenile Jury. This was a juvenile jury, sat out in Kangaroo Court session, and then came back and delivered the verdict. They said, "Okay, you're not going to pay for it, fine. You can't walk anywhere on the rug. You can't sit on the couch. You can't watch the TV. You're allowed to go from the door of your austere, Spartan, horrible little bedroom directly down the hall to the exit, and you can go directly down the other way to the bathroom, and that's it." So I spent the whole semester thinking I had no alternative to obey the orders of my betters. Then they, all being from Manhattan, went away the day the semester ended. They went back to Manhattan, hopped, you know, in their cars or on the train or whatever. But I had to wait to fly back to Minnesota. So I'm alone in the room for a day and a half. I happened to know that their mini refrigerator, which had come with the rest of the thing, contained loose bottles of champagne from the heiress's father's hotel. So I sort of wandered onto the rug, you know, first tiptoe. This was like the Orange Revolution or something, you know, tiptoe. Oh, nobody can stop me. Walked over, drank the champagne, got a little bit more courage. For some reason, I had a Swiss Army knife. I went over to the Steinway piano once I was good and drunk and cut every string on it. Doink, doink, doink. And then I pushed the keys and they stayed down. I knew I'd really done something when they stayed down. And then from there, I destroyed the room. I mean, destroyed the place. And then locked the door and went off on Christmas vacation thinking, you know, I could come back having been the only person there and somehow not be a suspect.
You want to read the passage of the destruction? Is that?
Well, yeah, I'll read it.
That's I love that, you know, only college students would think to make those rules, and only another college student would think he had to obey them.
Yeah. Well, I say the suite was now a concentrated before I wreck it. The suite was now a concentrated version of what the whole campus would come to represent for me. A private association of the powerful, which I'd been invited to visit on a day pass, that I sensed might be revoked at any time as arbitrarily as it had been issued. I lay on my bunk that night and raged inside, sinking at last into a seething sleep that was the opposite of rest. And so, anyway.
You wreck it on 96 and 97.
Yeah. Let's see. See, I wrote this book. The real reason I wrote this book was I had this great story to tell, but I had to wait for the statute of limitations to run out. I found myself guzzling Moët Chandon and standing in the middle of the rug watching the network news on the TV. I was smoking a Camel. I let the ashes fall. Then I dropped the butt, still glowing, and ground it into the Persian rug with my heel. Ah, the odor of burning silk. I lit a fresh cigarette, drank off the champagne, uncorked another bottle from the mini-fridge, and walked around to the back of the TV where I poured the wine through the ventilation slots in the plastic cabinet. As the liquid streamed over the hot internal circuitry, plumes of noxious vapor rose from the slots, through which I could see a sizzle of orange sparks and the occasional fat blue one. The blue ones popped like flashbulbs. They were gorgeous. On the screen, the picture shimmied, wobbled, then fractured into broad diagonal bands that thinned away and trembled down to nothing after another splash of wine. After that, I really got down to business. With a sturdy pair of scissors rummaged from Jennifer's antique vanity, I systematically clipped the harp of wires under the raised lid of Peter's Steinway. The instant I freed them from their tension, they sprang and curled away. An electrifying pleasure. I pounded the keys to make sure I'd killed the instrument. They made no sound, and they stayed down. As a reprise, I cut the spokes and brake cables on Tim's 10-speed bike, which he'd left out in the hallway. I ravaged the tires, too, jabbing them with the open scissor blades. The tire's loss of air unbalanced the bike, and it crashed over on its side. I stood on top of it like a trophy carcass and looked around for something else to wreck. That's an ungrammatical sentence. Adam peeked through the door about that time, his pupils gigantically dilated and glossy and slightly off-center in his irises. I waved him in and opened more champagne. He knew the whole story of the rug and said it was no wonder I'd gone berserk, but he told me I'd gone too far with the piano. He seemed to harbor some notion that musical instruments were sacred or potently symbolic, the way some people think of books and artworks. I told him to come off it and be a friend. This seemed to wound him. To patch things up between us, he filled his mouth with champagne and swished his cheek around, then spat a torrent of foam onto the sofa. Anyway, we destroy it, and then I fly home.
So, believe it or not, that's not actually your breakdown. That's the prelude to your breakdown.
No, that was my finest moment.
But
if I'd kept on like that, I would have stayed robustly sane.
So I have just two quick questions, then we're going to open it up to questions. Is the breakdown that comes a bit later, which is it's much quieter, more disturbing thing. I'm wondering, it was unclear to me reading the book whether it was it was an actual breakdown, or some elements of it seemed perhaps to be metaphorical. Can you talk about that, the breakdown that you had?
Yeah, you know, there's a problem with memoirs in the last few years. Few of them are true.
That was my next question.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't think that anyone should be limited by such petty considerations as the truth, especially when they're a creative writer. But in this case, I did limit myself to the truth only because it would not play in fiction. I mean, it was what happened to me at Princeton was too outlandish and too allegorical, sort of on-the-nose allegorical sometimes, to be anything but real. And the breakdown I experienced ultimately in my junior year there came about as a result of the fact that I've been pushing all my life. I've been passing these tests. I've been shooting for the 99th percentile, the gold star, the trophy, the mock United Nations champion picture in the paper victory. And now it was almost done, Princeton. I had not really learned much, and I had no idea what the hell was going to come next.
Can you describe the symptoms of it a little bit, what the breakdown was like?
Yeah, if anybody used to watch the Charlie Brown cartoons, when the teachers spoke, they went, and I was in a Chaucer lecture one day with this sort of esteemed medievalist, and I mean, Middle English is already a little, but, you know, I don't know what he's reading, you know, some Canterbury Tale excerpt, or maybe he's telling us about, the relation to Boethian philosophy or something I didn't understand. But I stopped being able to discern the spaces between words. And here's the key to the language and understanding it. You have to know where the words end and the new words start. Otherwise, the language sounds like, and it started sounding like that to me. And it was profoundly disturbing because it didn't stop when I left the lecture. And when I would read, the words would start to swim. And when I would try to write, I would get into this terrible conundrum. I don't know if anybody ever realized this about writing, but with each word you put down, you limit the number of words that can come next. So I was having to write a paper one day, and it was, you know, criticizing the architecture of the chapel on the Princeton campus. And I went, the, no problem. Chapel, no problem. two, you know, noun, then what? Well, they have to do something. This next one has to be a verb. I mean, I'm now already, I've cut my options by 90%. It has to be a verb, and it has to be something that a chapel can do. You know, the chapel swims. No, there's very few things a chapel can do in the world of actions. Is. It saves you. You know, everything exists, right? The chapel is. And then it had to be something. Something that a chapel could be. You know, and it had to be something interesting that a Princeton professor would be interested in reading about a chapel being. Not the chapel is huge, you know. And so anyway, by that process, I slowly found myself with a kind of writer's block that you can't friggin' believe. And I couldn't understand speech. And I told myself, if it stays this bad, and it really got worse and worse, and there were a lot of illegal drugs involved, I promise you, and there was a lot of exhaustion. And then there was also a lot of disorientation because literary educations at that time were extremely pretentious and developed on dependent on understanding something called post-deconstructionism. All I knew of post-deconstructionism was that I was suffering from it. And so I had this horrible breakdown, and I literally, I mean, because I want one or two of you to buy books, I'm going to leave in suspense how I treated myself for it.
Yeah, that's, you have to read the book to figure out how he got better to write the book, actually.
Yeah.
But so we'll open it up to some questions now, and at some point I'm going to jump in and ask you something about your writing process, which I neglected to mention. Okay, the man right there in the blue shirt.
Even though it sounds like such a good book, I've got to ask the reaction of your roommates when they probably suspected you.
That was another item of suspense that I thought might hook you. This has been a very clever mind game, but I'll give it away. It's all available on the internet, probably, anyway. They said they were going to put me in prison. The heiress, who was sort of the leader of the room, said, "My father's lawyers will make sure you go to prison." And I said, "For what?" She said, "Oh, you know for what." I said, "I have no idea." What? Because by then, I'd come back from Christmas vacation, and they'd replaced everything because they'd had insurance. I forgot about insurance. You see, what I didn't realize that was that people of this class never lose anything. It's all replaceable. And so by sort of riding out their accusations and playing dumb and letting the insurance companies do their work, I was able to stay at Princeton, also with the intervention of the quiet intervention of the university hierarchy. There were people way up in those towers who I never knew who turned out to be looking out for me for some strange reason.
Sorry, right there.
I'm wondering if you have children and how they're being educated.
Yeah, I do have children. I have a 10-year-old daughter, Maisie, 7-year-old boy, Charlie. I live in Livingston, Montana, which is a town of about 7,000 people. I was on the Stephen Colbert show a couple weeks ago, and he said something like, "Well, now you're part of this East Coast media elite, you know. What's your gripe? You don't want anybody else to be able to come after you? You want to pull up the ladder?" And I didn't. Because it's a Stephen Colbert show and you're on the defensive from the moment you enter the studio, I didn't answer. No, I live in Livingston, Montana, dude. But my kids go to public school there, and I have had some involvement, you know, with their classes and seeing what they're taught and how they're taught. And I've got to say, it's improved. It's improved. My daughter is doing a unit on the Depression in which they are, you know, they have made their own currency. They have a bank. They have acted out using very sort of sophisticated sort of modeling and thought experiments, the relations of investors to you know, people who've gone broke. Some people imitate hobos on the train. They have they look at Dorothea Lange photos of the Depression, which they have. I mean, it's this rich, kind of holistic and knowledge-filled lesson on the Depression. The Depression for me in 1971 was a one-paragraph SRA card in which the takeaway, so to speak, was, you know, market crash, knowing what market crash meant.
What did SRA stand for?
Science Research Associates. Yes. You know, it may have passed away, but there was a very Cold War. Remember the president's physical fitness certificate? It was like that to me was the model on which the whole rest of the education was based. You know, somehow in Washington, they had developed standards. I don't know how they'd come up with them. You know, if you're 9 years old, you should be able to do 11 push-ups in 37 seconds. And they'd done this for everything, reading, math, etc. And we were hitting these marks all the time, trying to make Nixon proud of us. We didn't know he had his own problems.
And the rope climb. There's a great passage about the rope climb.
Yeah, the president, the vicious and most torturous event in the president's physical fitness certificate competition was climbing this rope to the ceiling. And I guess I'm always alert for a good metaphor, you know, and that seemed a great one for the meritocracy, but it was all too real at the time. And you get up this rope, and this is what the meritocracy is like to me anyway. And the meritocracy meaning the system in which we advance each other and rank each other on our supposed intelligence and mental value rather than the amount of money we have or anything else. Well, you'd climb this rope and your classmates would stand around, supposedly cheering you, "Go, Walt, go, Walt." And they'd see you get to that point where you slow down a little. Because the rope climb's great. You jump on it, and the first 3 feet are a gift, you know, and the next 2 feet can be had through determination. But if you aren't built for that rope climb, that next foot can't be had for love, money, or, you know, your mother sold into white slavery. But everybody knows it. They know you ain't going anywhere. But it's like, go, go, don't quit. And you hang there, knowing you're going to drop, but not wanting, you know, and they won't give you an easy out. So just what would have been just failure, you know, becomes humiliation. And that was, that rope climb I couldn't do. But the other kind of rope climb I could do, and that was how I compensated.
In the orange?
How would you feel about getting rid of grades, and do you think that would help get rid of the anxious striving in a meritocracy?
Well, you know, I'm a novelist. I'm not an issues-oriented political or socio-cultural analyst. And the desire to compete and satisfy the ego and best the person beside you is to some extent a perennial human trait. But it can be exacerbated and manipulated by the masters, by the system, which it was. Now, in places that don't have grades, I've noticed that other kinds of status markers come in to replace them. What I don't like so much, and I'm not talking about grades at the Princeton level, you know, the youthful level. There were schools like that coming up when I was a kid. Grades are only interesting or useful insofar as they allow people to decide whether the student is, you know, learning. They're code for this kid's, you know, doing something. But as far as they are something to walk around and compare and have as a badge and a weapon to use against each other, no. So there should be a system, I think, for tracking people's, you know, performance to some degree. But to constantly hand them these statistics that they can wield against each other. That seems a little bit much.
I want to ask you quickly about your writing process. Do you write longhand? Do you write on legal pads, on a computer? Do you, you know, type? Do you revise extensively? Can you write on the road? You know, what is it like for you?
Yeah, I live the sort of life that allows me to write at all hours and any hour. And so I don't really have a process. I move a little bit by inspiration. And when I catch, you know, I'm like a surfer. I go out every day to the beach, but a lot of days there aren't any waves. When there are waves, I run myself ragged till the very last moment that I can stand up on the board. And when there aren't any, I surf the internet. A few years ago, I wasn't able to surf the internet on days where there weren't any waves because they didn't have the internet on the beach, so to speak. I mean, in Livingston, Montana, I only had high-speed internet 2.5 years ago, and I can tell my productivity has declined hugely. In fact, I'm serious, I'm wondering what the future of the novel is going to be now that the instruments on which the novel is composed also have access to real-time stock information and CNN and so on. Because my process, whatever lowly, modest thing it might be, has been hugely interrupted. But that's it. I go out each day to the beach. I wait for a wave. And if one comes, I ride it for all it's worth. And that means 5 in the morning, if necessary.
Back there.
Walter, I may have misunderstood you, but I thought I heard you say you don't believe in intrinsic intelligence. Did I hear you correctly? And if you don't, why?
Yeah. Well, okay. I don't believe in intrinsic intelligence of the kind that these tests purport to measure. They have identified a kind of operation in the brain, a set of problem-solving operations. Think about what the questions are like on your average SAT test. You know, this word is to that word as this word is to that word. Or, you know, if two trains start out on opposite tracks. And they involve some sort of basic, they involve having a large vocabulary and some basic sort of symbolic manipulation skills, but not necessarily a lot of real knowledge and not a lot of intensity of knowledge about any particular thing. In fact, the thing they always tell you on the SAT test is if you get stuck on a question that you can't answer, just move on to one you can. Well, a certain kind of person wants to answer the question they can't way more than the one they can. I mean, what the hell is learning but concentrating on the question you can't answer? Well, that person, though, is not, at the end of the day, considered as intelligent because they didn't get that score. So I'm not necessarily arguing that there's no intrinsic intelligence, just as I can't argue that there's no God. But I do know that we haven't found it. And I do know that the measurements that we believe we are making of it are deeply flawed. And I do know that somebody like Sonia Sotomayor, who went to Princeton, has been quite open about the fact that she got there with terrible SAT scores, considering, probably good given the general population, but terrible considering Princeton, Harvard. And she would not have been there were that the only measure. And now, and I think we'll see this when she's interviewed, we have a person who is a credible and perhaps wonderful but at least legitimate candidate for the Supreme Court of the United States, who wouldn't be there if the Supreme Court of the United States were only available to people above a certain SAT level.
Do we have time for one more? Okay. Does anybody have another question? Oh, over there. Okay.
Hi there. Yeah, I can see.
Yeah, Mr. Kern, I was here a couple of years ago when you were on the panel with Senator McGovern, and there was a question I wanted to ask then. I'm glad I have the opportunity.
You are a patient man.
Yeah. The Atlantic Monthly stopped printing virtually stopped printing fiction several years ago. Mm-hmm. And it looked to me like they just sort of folded up on their confidence in what good writing is after 9/11.
Well, okay, that's a two-part non-question. I don't believe that they've folded their tents as far as their attempt to get good writing, not at all, only because... Well, chiefly because this essay appeared post 9/11 in the Atlantic, and as have several other essays of mine. But that's a matter of taste. What isn't debatable is that they decided not to run fiction anymore in any regular way, which is a pity. And a lot of magazines have made that same decision. I used to be the fiction editor of GQ magazine. Read any fiction there lately? I remember the day the memo came, you know. No more of this stuff that isn't true, doesn't help people. I mean, this was reading between the lines. Isn't helpful in deciding what to buy. May, in fact, discourage people from buying certain things. Fiction tends to propound a view of life that makes you wonder if buying things is going to help. In that respect, it's rather alien to the general mission of the mass market magazine, especially like GQ, not necessarily The Atlantic. When a place like The Atlantic gives up on fiction, it's not because they want to. It's because they are trying to survive. Everybody there loves great literature. If they don't, they pretend to. And it's a sad situation when a place that has that sort of readership and aims for that level of sort of cultural relevance doesn't feel that it can sell enough ads to support those few pages of creative writing. And that's really what I do. I'm not a memoirist. I write fiction mostly, and that's where my heart is. And I grieve for it just like you do.
Did you find writing a memoir harder or easier than writing fiction?
Far harder than writing fiction.
Why?
Because I realized sometime during the process that just because it happened to me doesn't make it interesting.
Is that it? We can take one more.
Got somebody over here.
Yeah.
I remember taking and getting caught cheating on the SRA in the fourth grade. So I mean, you brought me back to the fourth grade. And then I remember I did make it all the way up to the top on the rope climb.
Oh, boy. What did that feel like, by the way?
That was wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, to look down.
Oh, it was wonderful. And everybody's cheering.
And they always slap the ceiling. It's not it's not enough to just get to the top. They then slap the ceiling, you know? And then they always come down. And they circle as they come down the rope, glide back down. It's just that must be the most triumphant few seconds in a child's life.
It was one of them.
Did the cheating on the SRA cause you to enter a life of crime or just, you know?
No, but I realize now that it was, after hearing you, because I was finding that I couldn't, you know, I wasn't getting 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't take it again, your score goes down.
Yep.
And so that's why I cheated.
Yep.
So, you know, I said, well, I'll go back and get it later. I didn't understand why you had to get it perfect on the first try if you've never heard this stuff before.
Right.
And so what changed is I think at that point, one, and also getting in trouble and being thought of as a, you know, a cheat and a...
Oh, you got caught.
Oh, I got caught, yeah. I got caught and the teacher called my parents and... I felt bad.
Mm-hmm.
So, sure. Question, what happened to the SRA and why? I'm glad it's gone, but...
It's not gone. None of these things are gone. They've just changed their masks. You know, I think the SRA still exists. I think McGraw-Hill runs it and owns it now, actually. Okay. You know, they're always going to find a way to educate students on the cheap. And... as I said, my children's teachers are better, I think, than any of the teachers I had in terms of their access to a sort of panoply of materials and techniques and creative approaches. But you know, to a certain extent, if they can put reading into a box, color code it, and you know, deliver it for $49.95 to the classrooms of America, they're going to do it.
I think that's it. Thank you all for coming.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.